Welcome to a very special episode of our This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is Sir Steve Webb, former pensions minister, now director of policy at Royal London, and of course, This Is Money's pensions agony uncle, and Michelle Cracknell, chief executive of the Pensions Advisory Service. And this week, perhaps unsurprisingly, given our guests, we're focusing on your pensions-related questions. So we'll be covering such topics that you've got in contact with us about, including breaching the lifetime allowance, what are reasonable fees and charges, plus inheriting the state pension, also what to do if you're self-employed, young or live abroad, and whether you can or should top up if you've been contracted out. All that and plenty more coming up. Just a reminder though that while there will be some great general guidance coming up, the team only have very basic information, so if you are confused or have any complex financial issues, then it's best to seek professional advice. For all things money though, don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little, give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
But first, before we get stuck into answering some specific questions from readers, I just want to get a very brief overview of where we're at with pensions at the moment, the changing landscape, auto-enrolment, state pension equalisation, etc., etc. So Simon, you've been editor of This Is Money for some time now. And I just want to get your quick take on some of perhaps the most popular issues, whether there are general themes that have been coming up over the years into your inbox from readers.
Well, pensions have always been very popular as a topic with our readers. And obviously the landscape has changed a lot over recent years. We've had the introduction of pension freedoms, so people can now keep their pension invested, use it how they want. We've had the flat rate state pension. We've had continued warnings that people aren't saving enough. And we've now got lots of people wondering how they're going to invest their pension, not just for retirement, but in retirement. So it's things to do with that that dominate what people are asking and what people want to read. And what it's nice to see is that it's not just people reading about how they can make their pension last or what they should do with their pension when they're retiring. It's also lots of questions and people reading who are in the younger bracket who are saving for their pension, and they're just as interested in reading an article that says this is what the pension pot you might need is, here's how to get it, as older people are.
I was wondering, with all the changes that have come in, auto-enrolment, and you mentioned pension freedoms there, whether the sort of the demographic is getting a bit younger of people engaging in their pensions.
Yes, it is. And actually, stories about auto-enrolment aren't that popular, to be perfectly honest. People are more interested in the stuff that says, this research says you need a £260,000 pension pot, here's how to get it. And that, to me, says that people are engaging with their pensions rather than just being bundled into them. Having said that, auto-enrolment is great because what it means is that lots of people who might not have had a pension now at least have something.
Michelle, as Chief Exec of the Pensions Advisory Service, just firstly remind us what the service does.
We're a public service and we're there just to answer any questions you've got about your workplace or your private pensions.
So if we don't answer your questions today in this podcast, you're the person to go to.
That's right. They can call us up, they can do web chat, and they can send online inquiries.
Is what Simon just said there something that chimes with you? The popular issues, people's engagement?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've increased the number of customers we were dealing with 4 years ago was less than 70,000. We're now, this year, we're expecting to speak to 230,000 customers. So the engagement levels have definitely gone up. We have about 3.5 million people visiting our website, which is an increase from below 1 million 4 years ago. So engagement levels are going up, but it's still quite small relative to the population. So more can be done, like podcasts we're doing today.
Is that engagement, though, Steve? You've been in the thick of pension policy making for years, or is it that the landscape has perhaps got a wee bit more complex?
It has got more complex. I think the biggest single issue is that we are more responsible as individuals than we used to be. I think about my parents' generation, they're in their 80s now. They knew exactly when they were going to get a state pension, their company pension, and my dad had a small company pension. That was all sorted for him, and that will last as long as he does. If there's inflation, it will protect him against that. If the stock market crashes, that's not his problem. The company has to sort that out. We're moved from that world. And I think if my kids are in their 20s, they don't know what their state pension age is going to be. They will probably have a pot of of money that will grow. They'll have to make choices about it as it grows, choices about when to take it. There probably won't be a day when they retire. It may be a process, a mix of work and pension. So we're really having to engage more because it's falling to us to make some of these decisions.
I'm talking about ages. I do want to ask you, because one of the big topics of the moment, state pension equalisation. What's happened there recently and why?
Well, we've hit State Pension Equality Day, which amazingly, it's 28 years since a court case said that men and women had to be treated equally for pensions. And finally, men and women are now getting pension age at the same time. And of course, we don't stop at 65. And I think now men are going to start getting interest in this debate. Sadly, they haven't really engaged very much so far. But now nobody in Britain very shortly will get a pension exactly at 65. It'll be 66 before we know it. I'm a young man. I won't get a pension until I'm 67. My kids might not get a pension until they're 70. So that's a very different world.
Or at all, but we'll get your views about the future and predictions, a bit of crystal ball gazing a little bit later on. But we want to focus on some of the reader questions now. So we've been inviting you all week to get in contact with us. We have lots. So apologies if we can't get through them all, but I'm sure there's plenty of opportunity coming up in the future with which we can answer them. Also, as Michelle pointed out, you can go to her organisation. But first off, what is the most efficient way to save for retirement if you're expecting to exceed the lifetime allowance with your work pension? Now, our first query is from a 28-year-old doctor on a 2015 pension scheme, meaning he's likely to exceed the lifetime allowance during the course of his career. He says, I'm currently saving an additional £400 to £500 a month into a LISA and a stocks and shares ISA, specifically ring-fenced for retirement funds. But I was wondering whether this is the most tax-effective way to save. I believe investing in a SIP loses its appeal given loss of tax benefits above lifetime allowance. I've considered handing money over to my fiancé to invest in her SIP and wondered what my personal options were. A person very much in love with their fiancé, it seems there. Firstly, Michelle, lots of elements to this that need explaining. But first of all, the one that sort of jumps out here is the LISA. We don't know a lot about this person's conditions. We don't know if they've got a house, but they are telling us that they're saving into their LISA for the future. Just remind us what it is, what it can be used for, and sort of the debates around it when it comes to saving into a pension or saving into this thing called a LISA.
Well, starting off with his pension, he's in the NHS pension scheme, which is a fantastic and very valuable benefit to have. So even if he does exceed the lifetime allowance, and there's a lot of water to pass under the bridge between now and when he reaches retirement age, he's in a very valuable pension scheme and he shouldn't see the lifetime allowance as any form of prevention, because even if he goes over that, he's still got a very valuable benefit in the NHS pension scheme. However, you know, it does make sense, particularly at his age, that he's making savings elsewhere apart from pensions, and ISAs are a great place to start. He can contribute up to £20,000 a year into ISAs, and in particular the LISA that you mentioned, he can put money into the LISA where he gets some money back from the government as well, and he can access that money, for example, for house purchases.
So this is the lifetime ISA, where you can either use it for a deposit on a house. There are details into that which I won't go into, but also you could use it as a retirement saving. And there's been a question, hasn't there, or a concern perhaps, Steve, that people would save into that over their workplace pension. Now, I imagine you wouldn't be advising that with an NHS pension here.
Certainly not. I mean, one of the great strengths of a workplace pension and the NHS pension, this is true in spades, is the very generous amount of money that your employer puts in. So although there are breaks for putting money into a lifetime ISA, and perhaps if you're self-employed and don't have an employer, that might be an attractive thing to do. If you've got an employer and they'll put money into a pension as well, that can double, treble your money, and pretty no other investment will do that. So in his specific case, he's doing both. Now, you mentioned this issue of the lifetime allowance, which is his central concern.
What is the lifetime allowance? Just explain to us.
That's right. So the idea is that tax relief, the break you get for putting money in a pension, is a valuable thing. And the government, successive governments, have decided that you should only be able to get so much of this privilege over your lifetime. So you used to be able, until a couple of years ago, to build up a pot of £1 million, roughly. It's gone up a little bit since then. But think about roughly £1 million. And the argument is you can save beyond that, but you don't get the tax break. Mm. So he's worried that if he works in the NHS for years and years, the value of his pension will be like £1 million worth and more, and then he'll not get any tax breaks. But as Michelle said, he might not get any tax breaks, but if his employer's shoveling money into his pension, chances are it's still worth having.
It's a nice situation to be in, is it not, Simon?
It is, and it's an interesting one, because one of the benefits of him saving into his pension, of course, is that he gets tax relief. Now, he's probably a 40% taxpayer, So with the lifetime ISA, he gets a boost, but he gets a 25% boost, which is the equivalent of basic rate tax relief, but he won't be getting the equivalent of high rate tax relief. The other thing that's interesting about it is we've heard lots of talk about the lifetime ISA, and it was brought in as this thing to try and put together the problem of, oh, I'd like to save for a pension, but I can't because I need to save for a house. Which is a neat idea, but actually probably those two things are separate and you should be doing them separately. And most of the use of lifetime ISAs I've heard for sort of long-term pension investment is actually from people who are quite rich. The people who talk to me about this tend to be people who work in the city or in the fund management industry and who've basically filled up their pension or used up their annual allowance. So it's interesting we've got someone who's worrying about busting his lifetime allowance using a lifetime ISA to save for retirement. And the final thing I'd say is, Steve mentioned why the lifetime allowance is there. I think if there's one thing I would remove from the pensions landscape, it is the lifetime allowance. It is done on the size of your pot, not the amount of money that you've put in. I think it puts a limit on a lot of people saving. I think it stops people from saving, and I don't think as many people realise they're going to hit £1 million as due. And you've got already got an annual allowance, and that is enough to stop people shoveling tons and tons of money into their pensions. And the other thing is it prevents the executive and board level class from benefiting from pensions to the same level as their workers. And if they don't get the same benefits, they're much less likely to improve their pension schemes, and they're more likely to vote things through that deplete them.
Well, I'll leave those sorts of answers to you, Simon, but I did see Michelle and Steve nodding along there, whether you think the lifetime allowance should or should not be here. Be here it is.
That's right, yes.
So we kind of have to deal with it. But there was one other element to this question, the idea of paying to their partner.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a common occurrence?
Of course, he could make, I don't know what their arrangements are regarding joint accounts, but there's no reason why their joint account can't pay into his partner's pension scheme. The point about how much tax break is interesting, is, you know, what level of tax is she paying? Certainly the idea of both of them having savings for income in retirement is a really good thing. And a problem in the past was there were too many cases where a couple did all the pension in, for example, the husband's name, and therefore the husband's income was taxed in retirement and the wife wasn't using up her personal allowance. So I think it's fantastic that he's putting into his fiancée's pension.
How much of an issue, and me too, how much of an issue, Steve, is it now that we're seeing the rise of the silver splitters when it comes to pensions?
It's a difficult subject to broach because, of course, you know, they're on the brink of getting married by the sound of it. You know, they don't want to think about a time when they might not be together. But we know that it happens not just earlier in life. It happens later in life. It happens post-retirement. And you get the couples marrying and living together in retirement. It's all much more fluid. And that's why, as Michelle says, each individual having their own pension in their own right is so crucial. The new state pension, for the first time, is really wholly based on each individual having their own pension, not I'm a married woman, my husband went out to work, I'll claim something on his. That's all going. And it's very important, therefore, that women in particular have their own pension in their own right.
All right, now, fees and charges. My wife and I currently have around £300,000 invested in a stocks and shares ISA. Also, we have around £300,000 invested in a SIP. Our financial advisor's charges are 1% on top of our Zurich portfolio charges, currently costing us over £6,000 per year. Do you think these charges are fair?
The question is what is the advisor doing for those charges? The conversations they should be having with the advisor every year is making sure that the advisor is continuing to service them and therefore would have a right to be receiving an annual fee. So that's a conversation that they should actually broach with the advisor. And just thinking about it, the advisor needs to be paid for the services that they're delivering to these two individuals as clients, but also, you know, it will be fair that the advisor will be doing some research, for example, on is Zurich the best product in the best fund, and so part of the fee would be going to contribute that collective research that the advisor firm will be doing. So the question, my point to them is go and talk to the advisor and make sure that you understand exactly what you're getting for your money.
But a lot of people, Simon, would, I guess with any sort of investing, the fees and charges issue, look at that and think, well, 1%, that doesn't sound a lot, does it? But does it? I mean, what's a standard? What should you be paying?
Well, it doesn't. And it's not really a lot, 1%. But then once you start getting above a certain level, it ends up being a lot of money. I think if you said to people 1%, that's all right. £6,000 a year, well, hang on a minute. What I would say is exactly what Michelle said, is there might be lots of other things that their financial advisor is actually doing for them that isn't just putting their money into some investments. And that's the mistake people make, is they think, oh, well, they're just putting in some investments. I could go onto a DIY investing platform and do that myself for much less money. But there might be other things they're doing. They could be making them invest in a tax-efficient way. They could be helping them make the right decisions. They could be stopping them from making a lot of mistakes. Yeah. So I'd just say to the advisor, we're paying you £6,000 a year. Please, can you tell me exactly what you were doing for the £6,000 and then make a decision based on that?
I'm surprised, Steve, that's not standard.
So there are two charges going on here. There's the money being paid to the advisor and then the money being paid for the product. Mm. And often a lot of these things are kind of hidden. You're often paying what they call a platform fee, so that, you know, just the place where it lives, and then you're paying to the provider and then you're paying to the advisor. I mean, it's good that the reader here is aware of all of these things. That's the first thing.
What's the first step in trying to find out these sorts of details?
Well, very often, I mean, in general, statements will have this sort of information, but sometimes it's buried. And, you know, so being quite persistent, ringing up, asking these questions. The rules have changed. There's all sorts of new rules now about disclosing charges. But even so, do people actually open in the envelopes? So you do have to engage. But I think asking searching questions, and a good advisor, for example, will be saying, well, as you're getting on a bit, you need to think about inheritance tax. What would happen if you, to the value of your home, if you went into care? What are you planning to do for your children? So there's a lot more, as Simon says, that the advisor might be doing beyond just sort of keeping an eye on the money in these products. But they have to justify these fees.
OK, so ask them. Right, now I asked you at the start if you get a lot of questions on one specific area, one topic. Well, now we have three around the theme of, if I die, will my partner inherit some of my state pension? So two questions. Firstly, I have claimed my state pension since I was 65. However, my wife, now 73, has never claimed. What will happen to our pensions upon death? Another reader asks, do you inherit your late partner's state pension automatically, or do you have to claim? So Michelle, what do you make of this? Firstly, does it make a difference if the surviving party hasn't claimed or one party hasn't claimed?
It depends upon when they retired and what type of state pension they're in, whether they're in the new state pension or the old state pension. From their ages, we're assuming they're in the old system. And therefore, you know, it does make a difference as to what has your husband done and what has your wife done.
Briefly explain to us the difference between the old and new system then, Steve.
Yes, so as of April 2016, if you reach state pension age after that point, you're in this new system, which is essentially a kind of a flat rate amount. You put your 35 years in, you get your £164 a week. There are lots of exceptions to that, but that's the basic idea. Whereas before that date, if you reach state pension age, there were lots of different components to your pension. And let's take this case we were assuming is on that old system. So they would have had a basic state pension, about £120 a week. And you don't exactly inherit that if your partner dies, but if you were getting less, then you can say, well, hang on, I'll use some of their national insurance record to beef mine up. Like a widow, for example, might happen. So under the old rules, your basic pension could be filled up to the full rate. That was one thing that happened. And then the second element was the state earnings related pension scheme, SERPs, as it was often known. And that could be inherited, part of it. So if, for example, one person dies, half or more could be passed on to the spouse. The exact percentage depends on their date of birth and so on. But the short answer is yes, some of it goes across. And although in theory the system should work this out, there's absolutely no harm ringing the pension service if nothing happens after a few weeks, because often it takes a long time.
Yeah.
And just to say, if you sadly have been bereaved, what happens is obviously you register the death, but then you're encouraged to do something called Tell Us Once. And this is a really good service whereby, rather than have to phone half a dozen government departments, you fill in the information that gets passed on to DWP, the council and various other bodies. And it just means that, for example, benefits that should stop when a person dies do stop, and also that the pension system should then do these calculations. But as I say, if nothing happens, a phone call to chase it up, and it should all be backdated to when the person died, as long as you tell them promptly.
So in answer to the second one, it should be automatic, but
I've heard of cases where it's taken a very, very long time, so it's worth chasing.
Had I read that question differently and said, I'm 45, my wife is 53, would you be telling me something different?
I would, because the whole system of bereavement benefits is different for people under pension age as for over pension age. So the idea of the working age system is to say, on the whole, happily, people live to a decent old age. So you have a separate bereavement system. And at the moment, what happens is if one person dies and they're part of a married couple or a civil partnership, then the surviving partner can get a bereavement allowance, a bereavement support payment, which is a lump sum, and a monthly payment, a bit more if they've got kids. But that married is very important, because if they're living together as a couple and they're not married, then it doesn't count, sadly.
Well, we do actually have a question related to that. My partner of 30 years has just died, really sadly here. We have a 26-year-old son. I know it was our fault that there was no will or insurance, but he worked to support his family, sometimes having two jobs. Why shouldn't his family get a widow's pension? And where have all the national insurance contributions he paid gone? So I suppose this is related to that common law wife, common law husband thing that doesn't exist. Is that correct, Michelle?
Yes, it absolutely does that. I assume that they haven't actually reached state retirement age, so there will be a bereavement allowance, but in fact, you know, there is no sort of state pension as such relevant for it. I think the other point to note on this whole part of common law is not just for the state pension, but for workplace pension schemes. There are different rules about how you have to declare whether you've got a partner that you're not married to, but you want them to be considered for benefits. If you don't complete the right paperwork, the trustees of that pension scheme have no opportunity of paying out the benefit, because it's not a discretionary benefit. So it's really important that you do check these precise rules with your particular workplace pension scheme. So in situations like this, if there is a widow's or perhaps a dependent's pension entitlement, have you registered the fact that you are a partner?
Simon, do you hear this quite a lot?
You do, and often, sadly, it's something that happens after the event. Mm. Obviously, it's a question about, I didn't fill in the form. We never got round to doing it. One of the things that is really important for people to do is a lasting power of attorney. The problems with that often arise because people leave it until too late. And that's something that gives you control over a loved one's finances or decisions over their health as well, if something happens. And people think about it being something for old people, but, you know, if you're younger, you're actually more likely to be in a very bad accident than you are to die. So it's important that young people do it as well.
There's another question here, a reader who's confused on the SERPs inheritance. I've lived with my partner since 1994. I was born in 1952, my partner in 1939. Now, my partner was a lower paid worker, so he invested in SERPs. I have no private pension due to working part-time with children, so I only receive the old age pension, what you were talking about earlier, Steve. If we got married, can you tell me if I would be entitled to any of my partner's SERP pension if anything happens to him? Steve, you're nodding along?
I am indeed, and the short answer is yes, marriage is the key, again. Living with them's not good enough, I'm afraid, from the point of view, because the whole national insurance system is based around legal marriage and these days
civil partnership
as well, that's right. And it's worth mentioning in passing that the government's announced that opposite sex couples will be able to register a civil partnership in future, and that might be a very important way for cohabiting couples to get into the system in future. That can't happen at the moment. But in this case, so it's an older couple. I think I get the impression of the lady whose partner is much older, and she's wondering what would happen. So if they were married, then yes, she could inherit part of his state pension, this SERPs bit, and the exact percent depends on their date of birth, but yes, she could.
Well, talking about working things out, calculating any inherited amount, a question here. I have recently begun to receive my state pension from September this year under the new state pension scheme when I reached my 65th birthday. Although I earned 35 years of contributions, my pension is slightly below the new full allowance, but I believe this was due to being contracted out for many years, and I'm content with this amount. My wife, on the other hand, will not receive her state pension until March 2024 when she's 65. In the event I die before her, will she be able to inherit all or part of my pension now in payment? And how would any inherited amount be calculated? My wife only has 11 years of contributions. If relevant, we were married in June 1987. You're both shaking your head, Michelle.
Well, I'll take the first part of that question. The first part about, because he was contracted out, he didn't lose that part of the state pension. It was just being provided through the workplace pension scheme instead.
What do you mean contracted out?
Just so in pension schemes, the employer could choose to pay a lower rate of national insurance if it promised the state that it was going to provide a pension through the workplace of a certain level. So he, as a result, has had his state pension cut back by the period that he was contracted out, and that means he's going to get that portion of what he would have got from the state through his workplace pension scheme. The workplace pension scheme may have an entitlement for his wife, and therefore he will get the benefit of, or she'll get the benefit of that on his death.
Okay, the second part of the question then.
So Michelle's described the company pension or the workplace pension bit. In terms of the state pension, the short answer is no, nothing. Because the way the new state pension works, this is for people who reach pension age after the 6th of April 2016, basically it's about you and you in your small corner and me in mine. Essentially, it's about you as an individual. The only exception to that is if you are getting more than the full flat rate, so you've got a really big pension, then part of that excess amount can be passed on. But this gentleman has said he's actually short of the full flat rate, so there is nothing to be passed on to his wife.
I guess the next question that we have is all about calculating. I imagine it's the old state pension. It's from a lady whose husband died sadly a few months ago. I believe he was in his 90s, and she sets out all the different components to what he got, what she got. So basic state pensions in here, pre-97 additional state pension, less contracted out deduction, graduated retirement benefit. Goodness me, Steve, I'm not going to read it all out because it's a bit complex. But how do you begin to answer this sort of query?
Going back to the old system where there were these two main bits, what this lady might find is that her basic state pension gets bumped up because many women of her generation perhaps paid a special reduced stamp for being a married woman, or perhaps weren't in paid work as much as a modern woman would be. So she may not be getting a full basic state pension. She can now say, well, my late husband paid in all his life. I'm going to use his record, not mine. That bumps me up to a full basic state pension. She could, in theory, inherit a few bits and pieces that he's got, but because of his age, I doubt he accumulated very much on top of his basic pension. So she may get a few pounds or something, but I wouldn't expect that to be very much. The big impact will be on her basic pension.
Simon, there's a lot of jargon and terminology in here. I don't know if people are confused. Goodness me, what do you do?
It's no wonder people get confused, is it? You think that's confusing? You should try writing an article explaining contracting out, and then you should read the comments from people below who seem to believe that the person responsible for trying to explain it in the article is the person responsible for all the complexity. I tell you what's interesting here is her husband, born in 1925, died in April 2018, sadly. Mm. Well, he would have retired at the age of 65, which would have been 1990, 28 years ago. So that just goes to show that you can live for a considerable length of time beyond state pension age, which is why if you want to be living not just on your state pension and retiring in comfort, and you're not going to be benefiting from the previous system of final salary pension schemes and such, it's a good idea to be saving.
It is indeed. Just one final question here on contracting out. Sorry, Simon. But I retired from the fire service in March 2015, age 51, after 25 and a half years. I also served 6 years in the army after leaving school. I now understand I was contracted out during these periods, much to my surprise. To qualify for a full state pension, I will need to pay additional national insurance contributions. Could you advise me on how to go about this, and also tell me if it's worth paying the extra? Michelle, I was surprised. They were surprised. Is that a surprise?
I think it probably is a surprise for a lot of people, because it does happen automatically, or used to happen automatically, through the workplace pension scheme. So the lower rate of national insurance contributions that we were talking about earlier that the employer was paying was on the basis that both the fire service pension scheme and the armed forces pension scheme were providing sufficient enough pension to provide that bit and more to him when he reaches retirement. The surprise obviously comes now, especially with the new state pension statements, because it actually shows you what the full pension is, and then the deduction, the contracted out deduction that will apply. Again, he hasn't lost the money. It's just being provided through the fire service and the armed forces pension scheme rather than through the state.
All right, so Steve, how do you go about paying additional national insurance contributions, and should you bother?
A lot depends on what he's going to do between now and state pension age. So if he was 51 a few years ago, he's probably got a pension age of 67, let's say. Mm. So he's probably got 15 years now.
He's a young man, isn't he?
Indeed. Now, he may be planning to do some more work, paying some more national insurance into the system. He's probably already got quite a lot of years in the system anyway. But he it might be worth paying voluntary national insurance to top up if he's not going to get a full pension otherwise. And the attraction of this is it's heavily subsidised by the government. So instead of going out to work and paying national insurance, if there's a year when you wouldn't have been doing that, you hand over a cheque effectively for roughly £750. I've rounded that a bit, but it's that sort of number. And in return for that, you get a year's worth of national insurance. Now, if you need 35 years for a full pension, a year's worth is a 35th. Again, in very, very round numbers, that's about 250-ish, just slightly under a year on your pension throughout your entire retirement. So you've paid a one-off lump sum of 750 and you've got back 250 a year, possibly for a 20-year retirement. So if you've got the cash, now he doesn't need to do it when he's 51 because he isn't going to see this money for 16 years. So, you know, there are time limits and so on. And you know, it's quite a detailed issue. But in principle, it's heavily subsidised by the government. If you're not going to get a full pension, it's well worth looking at.
If he was 61, would you say something different?
He should certainly think about it if he was 61. But again, if you can sit on the money until the brink of pension age, as long as you don't fall foul of time limits, then you might as well have the money until you need to give it to the government.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Now, the best things come to those who wait. Or do they? I have a defined benefit pension, says one reader, which is currently worth £7,100 a year when I'm 67. The scheme has now been stopped by my employers and we all have to start again with a defined contribution scheme. I asked for a transfer value and was told I could transfer out and they offered me £236,000. My question is, as I'm only 46 right now, will this transfer value increase as I get closer to my retirement options, or will it decrease? I'm capable of choosing my own investments with my DC scheme and don't want to lose such a good offer now if it will decrease later on. Michelle?
Well, the transfer value is calculated based on a number of assumptions that the scheme makes about investment returns, inflation, how long you're going to live. So in the short term, it can fluctuate up and down. So, for example, in 6 months' time, he could ask for a transfer value and it may be less than the figure that he's been quoted. However, over the long term, the closer you approach retirement, it's fair to say the higher the transfer value is because you're closer to when you're actually going to draw on the money. His question about transferring out of a defined benefit scheme, especially now that opportunity has ended and he's in a defined contribution scheme, he needs to think about really carefully, because this is a type of pension where he takes no investment risk whatsoever and it's unlikely he's going to be offered that type of arrangement again. So even if he's really good at investments, he could do that with his defined contribution scheme, but think very seriously before you ever move out of a defined benefit scheme.
Simon, the wider issue here?
The wider issue here, as Michelle said, is do you give up something that's guaranteed by someone else in order to take a risk yourself on the basis that you think you'll be better off? Now, if he's been offered £236,000 as a transfer value, he's going to have to put that £236,000 into another pension, it's worth noting. So for any of our listeners who think that he might just be able to take the £236,000 as cash, that doesn't happen. That's for a £7,100 a year pension. Well, if you do the maths on that, very simply, that's 33 years worth of pension that he's being offered based on that sum. That's a lot. However, that pension will rise with inflation. So actually, it's not 33 years. It's less than that. How you work that one out depends on what you think inflation is going to be. And it's too much to do on the back of a cigarette packet sat here. But he's got 21 years left. So if he takes that and invests it, yes, he could end up with lots of money. Or he could end up not doing as well as he thinks he's going to do. That £7,100 is going to be uprated between now and his retirement date. So that's also going to be worth more money. It's a difficult one, but I do think that if someone is offering you big money for something, then you have to consider that that person who is offering you big money for something sees that something as valuable. And the thing that they see as valuable is taking that liability for his pension away from him and getting it off their books. So if someone is prizing something that highly, maybe you should prize it highly yourself.
Steve, a fair point by Simon. This is something that we've discussed on the show quite a few times. It is very tempting. Some of these figures are huge.
They are. I mean, they're more than the value of some people's houses, certainly. Yeah. And the crucial thing is, first of all, by law, you have to take impartial financial advice, or financial advice at least, for anything above 30,000. So The good news is, before he could even do any of this, he'd have to sit down with an advisor. And increasingly, you know, there are bad guys out there, so you have to choose your advisor carefully. Perhaps check on one of the Money Advice Service website directories, these sorts of things. Talk to your friends if they've got a reliable advisor they trust. And that advisor will have to have a very individual conversation. And one of the questions I'll ask is, how do you feel about risk? If you take this absolutely rock solid guaranteed pot, this regular income, and you take it into a huge pot of money, would you sleep at night? How would you feel if Brexit does terrible things or whatever, whatever it is? If it went down 10%, would you wake up in a cold sweat? Or are you the sort of person who'd say, look, you know, this is a long-term investment, it'll go up and down, you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you hear people who've transferred who then get very fretful at minor fluctuations in the stock market, and you think they really probably shouldn't have done. But what an advisor will often say is secure an income. You know, you've got a state pension. If you're a couple, that might be $17,000 a year between the two of you. If you want a bit more than that guaranteed, then, you know, secure that. And he's still got 20-odd years to build up an investment pot, and he could do flexible things from age 55 with it. So, you know, you've got lots of permutations, but often an advisor will say, make sure you've secured a good baseline income, so if the worst happens to your investments, you're not going to starve.
OK, now to a question I imagine we will see more of going forward, if certainly current trends continue in self-employment, because it's risen rapidly over the last 2 decades here in the UK, with the number going up from 3.3 million in 2001 to 4.8 million last year, or nearly 15% of the working population. That's according to the ONS. So a concerned parent got in contact with you, Simon, about their 21-year-old son, who's a self-employed barber. What advice would you give him in finding the best personal pension to pay into, and how much he should be paying in percentage-wise? Which makes me smile, Simon, because this is a question certainly I get asked a lot, and it's what you were talking about a little bit earlier. People want to know numbers, don't they? How much? How much percentage? What does that actually mean? How much is a good pension? It's really hard to answer this.
Yes, and there's a number of general rules. So the simplest general rule to work on is that you want 15% of your salary going in, of your gross salary. And that's the money that you get from you, the money that you get from any tax relief, and the money that you get from your employer. Now, obviously, if you're a self-employed barber, you are in the position where your employer is not going to be paying in, mm-hmm. because you are your employer. Therefore, you have to pay in for yourself. And I think it's worth people who are self-employed always trying to think about the sums on their pensions in terms of, I need to be putting in as well. This, you know, if I was working for a company, this is what they'd be doing. So I need to put that in too.
Yeah.
So there's your bit, there's you pretending to be the company bit, and then there's the tax relief that you get on the money that you pay in. In terms of looking for the best place to start building up this pension, that's a big question. But it's a relatively simple one, because it's never been easier to open up your own account and start investing, whether that's an ISA, a pension, or a general investing account. And there is lots and lots of help out there. So if you go to some of the big players of this world, the Hargreaves Lansdowns, the Fidelities, the Interactive Investors, they will have help for you to choose funds, model portfolios, things like that. They have relatively low charges. If you go to something like a Nutmeg or a Money Farm or a Wealthify, they will build a portfolio of investments for you, again, for a relatively reasonable fee. As someone who's got a relatively small amount going in, the advantage is that if you choose something that charges you on a percentage basis, that actual cost in pounds and pence will be quite small, versus if you go for something that might charge you on a flat fee, say it charges you £80 a year or something, that might represent a bigger chunk of your money. But I would say go to thisismoney.co.uk/DIY investing, and there you will find our guide to the best DIY investing platforms. And that is a good place to start choosing where you want to invest your money.
Michelle? It's a great question, and, you know, fully encourage a 21-year-old just to get into that habit of saving. And, you know, they call it jam potting, in the same way as a self-employed person needs to put some of his earnings into a jam pot for the tax. He should also be putting some of the money into some form of savings. I definitely think at his age it shouldn't all be pension savings. Pension savings are very efficient because of the tax relief, but equally because he probably wants to get hold of some of the money to buy a house, leave his parents' home, he should also be putting it into other things as well. But the idea, the whole concept that when he does get his money in at the end of the week, it doesn't all belong to him. He should be putting some aside for the tax man, and he should be putting some aside for the future. It's a good thinking.
Absolutely, because it is so difficult at that age to decide where do you put that valuable money that you've got into saving for a home, a pension, just a general savings pot that you should all have. Steve, is there enough? I mean, that's young people. What about the self-employed at any age? Is enough being done to get people engaged there? Because, of course, we have auto-enrolment, but that's not really impacting, you know, the self-employed, is it?
That's right. Most of the self-employed who you mentioned in your 4.8 million figure, a few of them will have an employed job as well, but most of them won't. And whereas membership of pension schemes has soared for the employed, it's still falling for the self-employed. And roughly one in six, one in seven is putting into a pension every year. Now, some of them will say, my business is my pension. So maybe not the self-employed barber, but someone who's, you know, built up a business over decades and it's valuable and they'll sell it and they'll live off that. Some will have property, other wealth. So, you know, pensions isn't the only answer always. But in terms of a 21-year-old, I mean, the legal minimum next year for an employed earner will be 8% of salary between the employer and the employee, sort of roughly. So that would be a fantastic benchmark. You know, if the 21-year-old was employed by the barber shop, they'd have to, between them and their employer, be putting in 8%. Another of these rules of thumb, they're always a bit dodgy, but just to give you a flavour, is half of your age when you start.
Yeah.
So 21 divided by 2 is just a bit over 10. So if, say, he was putting in 10%, now maybe not throughout his working life, but getting going, that wouldn't be a bad number. You know, and given the other demands, as Michelle says, for short-term saving, maybe for a deposit on a house and so on, there's so many calls on his money. But the fantastic thing is, A, to get started and to make it automatic, a direct debit or something, not, you know, I'll spend everything else, I'll pay all my bills and then I'll see what I've got left for a pension, because you've never got anything left for a pension. Do that first, pay yourself first, and then spend the rest.
And I would say that if he could start now and he could get £80 a month going into his pension, he'll get basic rate tax relief on that. That'll take it up to £100 a month. That would be a really, really good start for someone who's 21. And if you start saving £100 a month now and you raise it as your earnings go up through your lifetime, you'll be all right.
All right, so we've covered the young, the self-employed. What about those who live abroad? And one reader asks, if my state pension is frozen because I moved to the wrong country, will it go up if I come back to the UK? Firstly, what are we talking about, the wrong country here, Michelle?
There are some countries where we have an arrangement that if you are drawing a UK pension, it will carry on increasing. So all of the countries in the European economic area that applies to. Probably the most famous wrong country is Australia, where, of course, is a country a lot of British people retire to. And if you are in Australia, you will receive the British state pension, but it will not increase. His state pension will not be increasing whilst he's in Australia. If he comes back to the UK, his pension will start increasing, but only at the level that he comes back to the UK at.
And it is a barmy system, frankly. I mean, you know, I was the pensions minister 5 years and I never fixed it. There are Caribbean islands where your pension does go up and other Caribbean islands where it doesn't. Australia, as Michelle says, Canada, South Africa, where it's all frozen. To fix this problem would cost about £500 million a year. And governments have successively thought if we'd got £500 million a year to spend, for example, on pensioners, we'd spend it on UK-based pensioners, we'd spend it on the health service, on social care. It's pretty hard to justify the system we have. It's grown up slightly randomly over the years, but that's how it's happened.
And well, we said earlier about the Lifetime Alliance, we may not agree with certain things of it, but it is what it is, so we have to deal with it while it's here. Some jargon buster questions now. Firstly, I'm 80 and have just had £76 per month deducted from my state pension because of the guaranteed minimum pension problem. What can I do? But before we answer what can we do, what is the guaranteed minimum pension problem?
So the guaranteed minimum pension is this thing that your company pension or your public sector pension promised. It's the promise they made to the government. So when you pulled out of part of the state pension, they said it's okay because we'll guarantee to provide at least this level, at least as good as you would have got in the state scheme, give or take. And in theory, there shouldn't be a problem because as long as they pay that, they're replacing part of the state pension and we're all happy. But it turns out that the numbers are wrong. In some schemes, when they've gone back, because this is dates back to the 80s and late 70s, some of the records were on pieces of paper, carbon copies sent off, but someone punched them into a computer and mistakes were made. And there's a massive programme going on at the moment of called GMP reconciliation, checking that the scheme's records are the same as HMRC's, and if they're not, the numbers have to change. And what's happened to this unfortunate, don't know if it's a lady or gentleman, but this unfortunate person is 80 years old. There's a number being knocked off their state pension for what the company company scheme has promised to pay. It turns out that the number's not right, and that person's pension, state pension, has now been cut. Now, it might be that somewhere else in the system, the money they're getting from the company scheme's been increased. I don't know. Mm. But that's a pretty brutal thing to happen, and there isn't a lot you can do about it.
Which was my next question at 80 years old. What can you do about it?
Well, this question about having the wrong pension amount paid to you is not uncommon, unfortunately, for the reason that Steve said. Some of the paperwork dates back many, many years and mistakes are made. And so a pension scheme has the right to come back to you and say, actually, we've been overpaying you a pension and you now need to pay us back £2,000, £5,000, £10,000. If that happens to you, the most important thing to remember is whilst the pension scheme is completely within its rights to reclaim that money off you, you can go back and say to them, actually, I can't afford it, or I have spent based upon the level of pension that you've paid me and I wasn't expecting this reduction. And they will potentially extend the period on which you have to repay the money. So it's worth just checking in before you just accept or struggle to find the cheque to pay back the overpayment amount, because they may come to a deal with you where you can repay it over a 10-year period.
What a concern, though. At 80 years old, goodness.
I know. And actually, as a wider point, it's always worth trying to actually track down the original pension documents. If you have your pension documents, when they get sent to you, do actually keep them.
A safe drawer with pensions written over it.
They might come in handy in years to come. I know someone who was widowed, and her husband, before he died, because he was unwell, he knew he was going to die, was told that his wife would get 50% of his work company pension. It was a final salary scheme. In actual fact, when they looked at his pension documents, because their husband was a member of the executive pension, she was entitled to 67% of his work pension. And bear in mind that the husband had checked with the trustee, the guy who ran the pension at the company, and he'd said 50%.
Wow.
When she checked, it was 67%. But it wasn't just 67%. It was 67% of what the pension would have been before he took his 25% tax-free lump sum. And they were going to give her 50% of the amount he was getting after he'd taken the lump sum. And that was a huge difference.
So it doesn't always have to be in the negative reduction.
Yeah, this was a major boost. And you never know. Maybe the company would have ended up paying out the right pension. But on the basis that he'd asked the question and the answer that came back was wrong, I think they probably would have paid out the wrong pension and she would have got less.
Goodness, check again. All right, one more then. My 85-year-old mother, who has dementia, has been offered a pie, a pension increase exchange, by her company pension. Should she take it? Before we answer that, Steve, what's pension increase exchange pie?
Now, faithful readers of This Is Money will know I devoted a whole column to pies recently.
Obviously.
And there was a picture of an apple pie or something on the top. And so a pension increase exchange, let's take those bits in parts. So your pension goes up each year, it's to do with inflation. Some of those increases, by law, the scheme has to pay you. Some of them are voluntary. The scheme has decided to. That's the rules of the scheme. So, but the law hasn't made them do it. They go above and beyond the law. And what's happening here is the lady's being offered, in exchange for those bits that aren't required by the law, she's been offered something in exchange, which is a higher pension today. And people are often offered that, for example, when they retire. So at 60, 65, whatever it is, you can have the pension increasing quite generously, or have a bigger amount now and a smaller increase in future. And some people want that, some people don't. I'm quite disturbed by this one. This lady, frankly, may not have a clue about the letter. She may be worried about it. And one of the things I tried to do in government was work with the industry to have a code of good practice about this sort of thing. Yeah. And one of it was just being very, very careful about contacting elderly members, vulnerable members. I would guess the scheme doesn't know that she's vulnerable, possibly. But, you know, frankly, you know, yes, there might be an arithmetic argument for taking it, because perhaps if she's not going to live for very long, a bit more money now might be better financially. But to be honest, does she want the hassle? Does she want to go through this signing forms? There's probably a financial advisor she has to speak to. So my strong feeling is I really wonder whether the scheme should have sent the letter in the first place. And if the family are asking what she should do, you know, my strong feeling is there's more to life than trying to tweak your pension a little bit at this stage and be worrying about it.
Michelle?
I absolutely agree that if the increases suit her, the maths doesn't really matter at all. She may find it very comforting, the family may find it very comforting that the pension is going up every year. If that's what suits her, then keep it going.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of our questions. We could go on all night, but we won't. But we did have a budget recently, so I want to look to the future. We had a bit of speculation, didn't we, about what would happen to pensions? And actually, not really a lot happened there, but that doesn't mean that is it. So, Simon, where do you think we're heading in the short and the longer term? But short term, first of all, what are the sort of the tweaks, the political changes that may be on the horizon that perhaps This Is Money readers would be looking at?
Well, the big thing that was talked about before the budget was the prospect that tax relief would get cut back on. This comes around every time there's a budget. The idea is simple, really. You save into your pension from your untaxed income. And that means that if you pay basic rate tax, you get boosted back up to where you would have been before you were taxed. And if you get pay higher rate tax, you get the same. Now, obviously, that does involve a scenario where if you are a higher rate taxpayer, you get a larger benefit. This is down to the simple fact that you pay more tax in the first place. And the principle just remains the same. But there's been talk that this will be hacked back because this is seen as expensive. The government's seen as losing money here. It's not technically actually really losing money. It's just not taking money. But, you know, the problem is there's talk of will there be a flat rate introduced, and where does that flat rate get introduced? Does it get introduced at 25%, which is what basic rate taxpayers are getting? Does it get introduced at 33%, somewhere in the middle? Do we stick with what we've got? That's going to hang over us for a long time, unless a chancellor stands up and says, I am basically going to make sure that this is the principle and this remains. Will we see that? I don't know. It's unlikely a chancellor is going to rule something out like that. We didn't see a cut to the annual allowance. We didn't see the lifetime allowance cut anymore. Those are the other places where we might have expected to see it. I think that what we do have now is we actually have quite a good pension system. We've taken ourselves a long way over a relatively short period of time. We now probably have one that's pretty much fit for the 21st century. But now what people need is certainty, because the one thing that I still read all the time in articles undermining all the good work that's gone into pensions over the recent years is, yeah, well, they'll probably take that back off you. Or, yeah, they'll probably just change the rules. So there's no point putting the money in. They'll just change the rules on you and take it back off you. And that's why I think we need a chancellor to stand up and say, these are the rules, these are the things we're going to stick to, and codify it in a way. And actually get some kind of cross-party agreement on that, because that's not going to work very well if the Tory chancellor stands up and then everyone goes, yeah, but Corbyn will just take it off us.
Steve, I feel it was slightly unfair coming to you on issues of sort of policy and pension, but I suppose you'll know better than anyone in this room about it. Do you think, to a certain degree, there is a bit of insecurity around what's going to happen in the future, and that is not a great place for anyone who's thinking about saving?
There is, and when Philip Hammond, before the budget, referred to the cost of pension tax relief as eye-wateringly expensive, he caused a few people to worry what he might do in the budget. And I think he got a bit of a windfall, so he didn't have to do anything nasty a few weeks ago. But I think it's a matter of when, not if, pension tax relief is cut further. My hunch is it will be more slicing and dicing, more cutting the limits. So, you know, you can put £40,000, many people in a pension, that in a year, that figure might come down. We've talked about the £1 million plus lifetime allowance. That's been cut and then frozen, then increased. They muck about with it all the time. My sense is it will be, and I say slicing and dicing, you still get £500 million or £1 billion from these changes. It's not small change. I think a government with no majority couldn't do big, bold, radical shake-up. There'd be just too many losers. That, you know, even tiny changes they struggle to get through. And a flat rate relief people often talk about would look clean, but it's actually quite messy because, for example, lots of public sector workers are in salary-related pensions, and it's really complicated to think how that would work. So my hunch is even a change of government, I think we'll see the cost of pension tax relief reined in, but probably more sort of shaving and cutting and snipping than a big radical reform.
Going longer term in the future, though, Michelle, I mean, we spoke about the age limit for the state pension going up. Do you think it will disappear altogether?
I don't know whether it would disappear altogether, because I think there does need to be some safety net provided by the state. I think the two interesting things I would pull out from the budget is, one of them is they did mention about the self-employed, and you mentioned it earlier. There are more self-employed people, and there was a commitment to try and think about how to help those people save towards their retirement. And the other one, which is a good news story about pensions, was how can we help people keep track of their pensions? There's £20 billion that people have lost track of the pension scheme that they were in. And there's talk about how can we create some form of dashboard, some sort of system, so that you can log in and find out where all your pensions are. So they were the couple of things I picked out from the budget, which are potentially good stories.
Where are we at with the pensions dashboard, Simon? Because we've been hearing about this for quite some time now.
Who knows? Hey, right, okay. I mean, as someone who is the editor of a website, I know quite how difficult it can be to get stuff built and done technically. But this one isn't just down to techies dragging their feet. This is down to the whole concept of the pension dashboard getting off the ground. You'd think it would be easy, though, wouldn't you? Because it is attached to your national insurance number, yeah, and just a system where you put in your national insurance number and it pinged up all the things that belong to you would be much better.
The final one, Steve, we've spoken about the changing workplace, the changing demographic. Is the pension system sort of fit for the current age? If not, and you were still in your position as pensioned minister, there's still time, what would you do to make sure that the state pension, that pensions, pension savings, retirement, attitudes as well, all of these elements are sustainable going forward?
It's tempting to be very doomy and gloomy about pensions. I used to say I was the minister for a subject that never appeared in the headlines without the word crisis or scandal attached to it. And yet there is a glimmer of a good news story, and I was encouraged by what Simon said, really. You know, we're moving to a state system that I think is more fit for purpose. It's a bit complicated, the transition's complicated, but the eventual system, it'll be fairer to women, it'll give a firmer foundation. These new pot of money pensions that all new workers will build up, we're not putting enough into them. But as a structure for a world where we change jobs, maybe we're self-employed, maybe we have time out of paid work, we flexibly retire, in some ways they fit that a bit better than a final salary pension that assumes you have one employer all your life. So they do have that flexibility. And the thing about the pension freedoms from a couple of years ago is it's given people choices and ownership, and it's, I dare say, got a few people excited about pensions. Because instead of it being this punishing, finger-wagging, moral imperative and sacrifice and all of that, it's suddenly, this gives you choices. The pension pot gives you choice about when you start work. It gives you choice about maybe if you've saved enough, a bit of travel later, and a bit of time with the grandchildren. Suddenly a pension becomes a positive thing. And if we can do that, we'll have achieved something.
Steve, thank you very much. Michelle, thank you as well. Thank you also to everybody who got in contact with us. Obviously, we couldn't get through all of your pensions questions in this podcast, so we'll, of course, do our best to answer them in the coming weeks. And as always, if you have any queries on pensions, Michelle, how can people get in contact with the Pensions Advisory Service?
Well, the Pensions Advisory Service, if you log on to our website, www.pensionsadvisoryservice.org.uk, we have a web chat service and we also have online inquiries, or you can call us up 0800 011 3797.
And if you want to get in contact with the This Is Money team, you have any questions on pensions or indeed any other money matter, Simon?
Well, the first thing I would do if you have any questions on pensions is come to This Is Money on Monday afternoon, when we will be hauling these two into our offices for a web chat. There is no rest for them. It will be from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock. Come to This Is Money. You will find the web chat there and you can ask your pension questions and we will endeavour to answer them. Beyond that, editor at thisismoney.co.uk, send in your questions or tweet us at thisismoney.
And of course, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.